Hey, it's Dr. Mike T. Nelson here, and I've got an awesome interview coming up after this with Dr. Peter Fitchin. He is a PhD in nutritional science from the University of Illinois, has a master's in biology and a bachelor's in biochemistry with a minor in nutrition from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. In addition, he's co-authored 17 different peer-reviewed publications related to nutrition and exercise, which is related to the topic that we get in here today about what to do if you are stuck at a plateau for body composition and fat loss changes. He's also a certified strength and conditioning specialist through the NSCA, the National Strength and Conditioning Association. In addition to that, he's also has a great background in applying this both to himself and also with different competitors. He is a competitive natural bodybuilder since 2004 and won his national pro card in 2012. He recently even won the pro class at the 2016 NGA Northeast Ohio Bodybuilding Championships. He currently lives in my neighboring state here of Wisconsin, where he runs his company Fit Body and Physique. Works with a wide variety of clientele, from those just starting their fitness journey all the way up to competitive bodybuilders and powerlifters. So what I love about him is his passion for everything related to bodybuilding and nutrition. And I also had the pleasure of working with him as one of my clients. And the reason I mention that is it's pretty rare to find someone who has his unique combination of both extreme knowledge in the academic area and also in the applied field, both to himself and to his clients. In addition to, I can say that he's actually very coachable. So some people who have a huge amount of knowledge and work with a lot of people, not quite so subjective to receiving feedback on their own, but that is definitely not his case here. So big shout out to him. I've known him for quite a while. And as I said, we get into talking about plateaus and what to do to break through them for better body composition. So check it out. Welcome, Doc. How are you doing today?
Good. How about you?
Doing good. Doing good. Thank you very much for being on here to talk about what to do for kind of fat loss in body composition once people hit a plateau. So super excited to have you on here. And kind of before we get into a little bit more of the weeds in that area, in your mind, what do you consider kind of the big rocks that people need to have in place before they kind of get into the more nitty-gritty stuff? Because it seems like everybody wants to take the super advanced route, like off the start. So what are things they should be kind of paying attention to before they get to that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think one big thing is, you know, weight loss is determined by energy in versus energy out. So one big thing I would pay attention to is obviously the energy inside of things. So calories are going to be important. Having an idea of what your calorie intake is and, adjusting it accordingly to get yourself into a deficit. Also, protein is going to be important. I know in your class you talked about protein.
Yeah.
But it's important for preserving muscle mass. Calories, protein, and then probably exercise would be like the three biggest things, especially if you could include some resistance exercise in there, because that's going to help you hold on to muscle more so while you're dieting, and that'll cause a larger change in body composition. And then also on the exercise side of thing, NEAT, that non-exercise activity, I think is pretty important also. Someone who's a couch potato and doesn't move throughout the day isn't going to expend nearly as many calories as someone who makes an active effort to get up and move around more during the day, go for some walks, or maybe work some more active job or something like that.
Cool. That's awesome. Yeah, I definitely agree with all of those. What do you consider as a plateau? And we'll talk a little bit more about how body comp is measured and that kind of stuff. But is there any sort of markers you have in your head? Because I think My guess is it's probably longer than what most people would be, because I'm sure you've gotten this where, you know, some client calls you up and like, oh, I haven't lost any weight for like 3 days now. I think I'm at a plateau.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it, you know, it's going to depend on what the person's goal and timeline is. You know, someone who's dieting for a contest, what we call a plateau when you only have so many weeks to get there is, you know, it's going to have to, you know, it's going to be less time of not seeing loss than someone who, you know, is just dropping 20 pounds for overall health, no real timeline. But at the same time, yeah, I like to look at, you know, body weight with weekly averages rather than, you know, a daily, you know, rather than looking day to day. So I oftentimes will have people weigh in every day, but that's just so we can look at the average of the week.
Sure.
You know, and so, yeah, if you start seeing 2-3 weeks in a row, your average isn't moving a whole lot. Probably, you know, and, you know, looking also visually, you're not really seeing much, you know, it might be time to make some adjustments.
Gotcha. And I know it's going to differ for competitors or people that are not competitive, whether it's a weight class sport or physique athletes, but what are your kind of favorite ways of measuring body composition? Do you use pictures, scale, measurement? And then related to that, how do you deal with clients who possibly may be gaining some lean muscle? So the, or I should say lean body mass, if you want to be more accurate. So the scale then, you know, may not be moving if that's the only indicator that you're using.
Yeah. So I would say that, so I'm not a huge fan of having people track body fat percentage just because most of the methods that they're using, you know, that they have access to, like a Skinfold or BIA, actually have quite a bit of error. James Krieger actually put together a really good series of articles on the pitfalls of body composition assessment. I'm not sure if you've seen that, but he reviews the literature on how accurate they are for an individual versus a mean.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, and, you know, there's quite a bit of error. I mean, there's less error, obviously, for things like DEXA than there is for, like, BIA. But, you know, there's still a good amount of error. And so, and most people don't have the ability to go get DEXA scanned. And there's a limit to, you know, with the radiation, how often you want to be getting DEXA scanned. Even though it's a low dose, you don't want to do it every week.
Yeah. And they actually put limits on it too, because I wanted to see how much variability there was. So I called a local lab here and I wanted to do a DEXA, like pretty high frequency over a short period of time. They wouldn't let me.
the IRB during grad school let me do, I did 7 over a 6 month period during a contest prep for a case study.
That's high.
Which I was amazed they let me do that.
Yeah.
You know, because a DEXA, it's about 1/10 of a chest x-ray, if I remember correctly, for radiation.
Small.
So, I mean, I still had less than one chest x-ray worth of radiation, but it's still radiation I was exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to pay attention to a combination of things. So, yeah, the scale would be one thing I pay attention to. You know, and like you said, it may not always correlate. So especially if someone's a beginner, you know, you can see meaningful muscle gain and fat loss at the same time. You know, when I'm working with someone who's dieting for a show, who's been lifting for a while, generally you're not going, you know, you're dieting to such an extremely low level of body fat. Combine that with being an advanced lifter, it's going to have to trend down from the start to the finish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to gain muscle that quickly. But, you know, so that's just one factor, though. I also pay attention to pictures. You know, visual change, I think, is very important. Because, yeah, you can sometimes see some visual change without the scale moving much. And so pictures are important. Oftentimes, you know, I'll have people take measurements, you know, like waist circumference or hip or, you know, or limbs. You know, and just see, you know, just give us another marker. And then I also like to pay attention to performance in the gym. Because, you know, just because the scale's going down, unless someone's extremely lean and near stage lean, I wouldn't want to see performance in the gym just like, you know, dropping like a rock. That's generally not a good thing when it comes to trying to hold on to muscle mass and maximizing body composition change, because, you know, ultimately the goal is fat loss and not necessarily weight loss for the majority of people, you know, and fat loss, you know, weight loss, that's just the number on the scale going down. You know, that weight's coming from all kinds of different tissues, muscle, fat, water, you know, whatever. You know, fat loss, you want to hold on to as much muscle as possible to drop as much body fat as possible. And that will maximize, the change you see in body composition.
Yeah, it's a good point you bring up about body composition too, because you know, I've done that with even, you know, competitors, as you know, since I've worked with you a little bit. I think there's a tendency to, as a competitor, I understand the kind of dichotomy, right? Because, you know, if you're competing in a physique show or something like that, nobody cares how much you lift the day of the competition. It's not a powerlifting meet. It's not a CrossFit competition. But I agree with what you're saying, that the stimulus of what you're imparting on your system shows up in performance, right? Mm-hmm. So if your deadlift drops 75 pounds and you just started your prep, then holy crap, something's not going right.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, until you get to those really extremely low body fat percentages, which I mean, for someone who's not dieting for a competition, I would that's usually it. When your strength really starts tanking and you really start feeling the effects of a cut, that's kind of usually where I tell someone who's not dieting for a show, like, hey, we're getting below what's sustainable. Like, there's no point in going here unless you're getting on stage.
Yeah. So do you find that that's probably one of the more, I guess, better indicators to use kind of along the way?
Yeah, I like to pay attention to just, you know, hunger signals, hunger signals, energy, even just like mentally how into it, that, you know what I mean, how mm-hmm. easy it is to stay with it and stay consistent. Performance in the gym, something I pay attention to too. Because I think we all have that, any of us who have been stage lean and had striated glutes, there's that point where you're, I don't know, for some people it might be 10 pounds above, for some people it might be 20 or 25 pounds above, you know, it's a little different from person to person, but, you know, there's that point where you get below there and things just don't feel right. That's a point I try to avoid, you know, myself or with clients, unless you're going to go, you know, take it all the way down to stage lean and compete. You know, I try not to really take it, you know what I mean, that far, because it's not sustainable.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point too, because, you know, someone who's in the sort of general population who's looking for more body composition changes, I think there's a lot you can learn from, you know, people who are competitive and going to the extreme. But I think your point is exactly correct. That gets lost is they always just assume, well, I'm on a quote unquote diet and it's just going to suck, right?
Yeah.
And they left to their own devices. What I've seen in clients is that they want to slash their calories by like 1,000 starting tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that, wow, it's supposed to really suck and I'm going to be super extreme to start. And the reality is you don't need to do that at all to start.
No. I was just having I was emailing back and forth with a client this morning who's down 15 pounds over the last like 3 months. And she's like, I can't believe I'm hardly doing any cardio and I'm not really all that hungry. It's crazy, you know, because we took it slow and we didn't do anything crazy like during her last prep.
Yeah. And they assume that something's wrong then, right? Because all their other past associations have not been where they're at now.
Yeah.
And they get really confused.
Yeah, I've had clients like at like a week, 2 weeks out, like tell me, I've had multiple clients say, hey, are you sure, like they're looking ready, they're stage lean, they do well at their show, but like a week or two out they're like, are you sure I'm pushing hard enough? You know, in the past I was doing like hours of cardio a day and, you know, eating like less than 1,000 calories a day, and, you know, you have me only doing cardio like 4 days a week and you know, I'm, you know, still eating like, you know, 1,200 a day. Are you sure we're pushing hard enough? And I'm like, well, take a look at your pictures. I mean, you're leaner. You look better than the last time, you know? I mean, I've had that come up multiple times.
Yeah, and I think especially related to the topic of plateaus, how that comes in too, is that trying to separate sort of the results from kind of how you feel. And then also related to that in terms of a plateau, I think it was Alan Aragon who said once that the end goal is you actually want to be on a plateau. For someone who's in more of the general population,
yes,
your goal is that you want to get to wherever you feel your ideal body composition is. And by definition of a plateau, I think my brain goes more to the engineering side of you're just, for lack of an engineering algorithm, it's like this massive damper, right? So if you look at a suspension system on a car, you've got a spring and then you've got sort of the viscous, you know, fluid, that's what they call a dampening. And those have different mechanical properties. But I think of your body that you want this kind of huge dampening of any potential inputs and even outputs, right? So what that looks like in real life is, oh, you know, I can go out to dinner and, you know, it's not that big of a deal, right? I can do more things that have more variability, and I'm not going to gain a lot of weight. I'm probably not going to lose a lot of weight either, but it's very easy for that person to maintain that. So they actually want to be at a plateau. It's just the plateau has to occur lower than where they're currently at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think I've even found that that's been helpful, just defining that to clients, because they assume that when they hear the word plateau that, oh my gosh, this is a horrible thing. It's like, no, it's just, you know, your body trying to readjust to where you're at. And the reality is you want to be at a plateau, just a different one at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You want to sustain the progress you've made. And I, you know, I tell clients something along the same lines that, you know, who are general population, that, you know, maintaining the progress when you get there is still going to take work.
Yeah.
But it won't take as much work as what it took to get there, because you don't have to be in a deficit anymore.
Yeah, and as we all know, when you look at the literature, right, for people who do whatever diet, doesn't take your pick, you know, the amount of people who can sustain that are like single-digit percentage, right? Or if you look at The Biggest Loser, there's actually some research documented on that too, that most diets do a pretty good job of having people lose weight, but it's the maintenance of that that I think is very hard. And I've often wondered if they have this such a negative, maybe mental connotation to a plateau, that even once they're done, maybe they're still kind of avoiding staying there. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. That's kind of random.
I don't know on that, but I know that if you look at the literature, they've done studies looking at different types of diet, and you know, they all, any diet that causes a, you know, calorie deficit or energy deficit is going to cause weight loss. But when they look at sustainability, you know, it's highly, highly, highly correlated with someone's, you know, ability to stay consistent with the diet. You know, the more, you know, more someone deviates from their diet, you know, while they're trying to maintain their goal weight, the more weight they regain. And so I think that really brings up the point that whatever you're doing has to be more of a lifestyle, you know, and something you can sustain rather than something you're just kind of doing right now.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. It's probably a little bit more open-ended question, but what are your thoughts about what causes a plateau? Because I think as humans in general, we're very programmed to think linearly, right? We're just like, all right, I'm just going to start cutting out, you know, X amount of calories, right? Everyone's heard the 3,500 calories is 1 pound of fat, and it's an approximation, but there's some cool studies that you look, if you take that amount and you just linearly extrapolate it over the course of a year, you find out that it's not a simple linear extrapolation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I often explain to clients it's the same as, well, if you could just add 5 pounds to your bench press every week, you'd go into every gym and you'd find, you know, people benching 400 pounds. That would be like routine, right? But
yeah,
everybody knows that that just doesn't happen. So what are your thoughts about what is kind of going on that's related to people hitting a plateau?
Yeah, so, you know, when someone hits a plateau, I think the first thing to look at is, assuming they really are plateaued, one other thing to look at is, are you actually eating what you think you're eating? You know, people are notoriously really bad at tracking intake, and we have, you know, there's that study from the New England Journal of Medicine from the 90s where they took middle-aged overweight women who claimed they couldn't lose weight on 1,000 to 1,200 calories a day, and they put them in a metabolic ward where everything was controlled and found out they were eating like almost 2,100 calories a day. you know, and so I think that's one thing to look at. But assuming someone's really plateaued and someone's really eating what they, you know, they're accurately tracking everything, there are a few things that, you know, adaptations that happen during dieting that can cause plateaus. I mean, one is just, you know, you're going to see a slight decrease in basal metabolic rate. It's not huge, but you're smaller. There's less of you to support, you know, and, you know, as you lose weight. You're going to, a lot of times you'll see a down regulation in NEAT, some of that non-exercise activity. Some of the NEAT is, you know, involuntary. So you know, the twitching, the fidgeting, you do less of that, you know, than you would, you know, if you're eating more food. And then some of the reduction in NEAT is voluntary. So, for example, you feel tired, so you don't get up and move as much. One thing you can do to counteract that is track steps during the day to kind of offset some of that, and make sure that NEAT does stay higher. That can help. But some of that involuntary part, you there's no way to really get around it, because we can't control twitching and fidgeting. And you know, also there are hormonal changes that happen. I mean, when you're dieting, I mean, thyroid hormone goes down, leptin goes down. You know, if you get lean enough and cut far enough, testosterone goes down. You know, and so you start to see some of these things, and you know, a combination of all of those factors probably lead to, you know, weight stalling and plateaus.
Gotcha. You had mentioned leptin, which I find kind of fascinating. Do you want to expound a little bit on that? And then also, is there really any truth to different things, high amounts of carbohydrate and these kind of different refeeds you see every once in a while to sort of, using my little air quotes here, reset leptin levels?
Yeah, so leptin is a hormone that is secreted by fat cells. And so when body fat is higher, fat cells are more full, you secrete more leptin. It helps you feel full. It also there's a ton of leptin interactions with other metabolic processes and hormones and things. I'm not an expert on it by any means, but it's involved in a lot. And so when you diet, you know, body fat decreases, so your fat cells are less full, you secrete less leptin, you start to feel more hungry, metabolic rate starts slowing down. There's evidence that acutely, like if you give someone who's in a deficit a really high carb day, their leptin goes up, but it goes right back down the next day.
So it's just responding to the acute stimulus. It's not like staying elevated now for 7 days or something like that.
There's some evidence, and people have started playing around more with multi-day refeeds where 2 or 3 days, you know, might have more of a prolonged effect. But then at some point you still need to be in a deficit. So if you start putting 2 or 3 days up around maintenance or maybe even slightly above, you're going to have to be in a pretty harsh deficit the rest of the week mm-hmm. to make up for that and still lose weight at your target rate. You know, for me, I mean, I think the biggest benefit to incorporating refeeds, I mean, is probably psychological. You know, just having that day where you're like, hey, I have a day where I can eat a little more today, you know, that can be a really beneficial thing because it helps you kind of get through the bad days knowing, hey, I got a day I can have a little bit more, fit a little bit more in. The other benefit I think is pretty big with a refeed day is potentially putting it on the day of or the day prior to a hard workout. Yeah. You know, so if you have like a heavy squat and deadlift session each week, you know, you're doing this heavy lower body, you know, putting your refeed day the day before or day prior is going to keep performance higher. And kind of like we talked about earlier, that still is key, even, you know, for someone dieting for a body, you know, bodybuilding contest or someone in the general population dieting just to, you know, for physique purposes to look better. You know, performance in the gym is still going to matter.
Yeah, and I think also that you mentioned the psychological side too, that, you know, like let's say your heavy deadlift day is Thursday, so your refeed day kind of starts on Wednesday, goes maybe through part of the day Thursday, or however you want to set it up. I think that also gives people something to look forward to. Mm-hmm. And there's not much, I think, that's more demotivating than going to the gym and having everything feel harder and harder, especially when a lift is, you know, deadlifts and squats. I think they can be fun, but they're a lot harder than preacher curls, you know. I think I've just noticed that having those lifts feel hard seems to have a bigger, more psychological impact on people than, you know, some of the other stuff. And I'm not sure if that's just because they're so performance-based or if it's just, I don't know, how people are wired, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I can definitely see that even in myself. But I mean, it's hard too because, you know, if you cut down and maybe you maintain strength so that pound for pound your strength's similar, maybe your Wilks even goes up a little bit. But you know, maybe you cut far enough and you see like a 5 or 10% decrease in strength because of your cut.
Yeah.
You know, on a dumbbell curl, that might look like going down one pair of dumbbells, you know, like, you know, on a squat, if you have a 400 pound squat, that might look like 20, 30, 40 pounds off your squat. You know what I mean? It's a lot more noticeable, you know, than curling 5 pounds less.
Yeah. I think there's something to do with how humans think very visually. You know, because I'll often ask people, like, if it's a guy who, and they say their goal is just, you know, to deadlift, let's say, 400 pounds. And the first question I'll ask them is, okay, so is it more important to you to deadlift 400, which is a nice round number, or is it more important to you to deadlift 405 because you can see four 45-pound plates on a side? Most of the time, they'll say 405. Now, it's only a 5-pound difference, but I think there's something about just visually seeing like four plates, or, you know, visually seeing whatever the goal is, I think sometimes is more motivating, or maybe it's something you can just visualize more, I guess. I don't know, but I always found that kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that in myself. I mean, I remember when I was younger and I first could press 100-pound dumbbells on dumbbell bench, like, I just went from 90s to 100s. Like, I was just like, well, I'm not going to press 95s. I'm just going to go for 100. You know, like, I rarely used the 95s. I used the 90s or the 100s.
Yeah, and I know that for me it was the same. You know, my goal for the longest time when I started lifting was, you know, to deadlift 405. Same reason, right? I wanted to see, you know, four plates on a side. You know, mm-hmm. It just, there's something, I don't know, maybe that's a whole cultural thing too. But anyway, so can you become too aggressive, like trying to get through a plateau that you could harm your metabolism? I know the term sort of metabolic damage has been thrown around a lot. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't think you could necessarily damage a metabolism. Metabolism adapts when you're dieting, but nothing about it becomes damaged, you know? And so, yeah, there is some evidence, I think it was from some of the Biggest Loser studies, where they showed that the larger deficit someone was in, the more their metabolic rate adapted and decreased as a result. You know, and so that's kind of evidence for probably not going to crazy extremes, because it might make loss more difficult, or maybe make your chance of regain higher. You know, because people who had, for the most part, people who had smaller deficits had less metabolic adaptation. And so, you know, I typically, the number that's thrown out there a lot of times in the fitness world or bodybuilding world, you always see this 0.5, 1 and 1.5% of body weight weekly. And so, you know, and I think it's not a bad thing, you know, bad starting point for most people in terms of rate of weight loss. And so for someone who's overweight or obese, you know, 1.5% is probably the highest you want to go a week, just to, in the interest of preserving muscle. So, you know, that would be like a 300-pound guy. You can maybe get away with 4 or 5 pounds a week, you know, initially, and you wouldn't see meaningful muscle loss. You know, whereas if you were an average body composition, just trying to get leaner, 180-pound guy, you know, that's where you're looking at probably more like 1% is the high end. So you probably want to be looking at like 1, 1.5 pounds a week. And then, you know, on the other hand, if you were extremely lean and you're in those last stages of contest prep, you might even want to be closer to 0.5% a week, because you're so susceptible to muscle loss. And so that could be the 160-pound guy, you know, just about ready for a show, dropping 0.5 pound a week or something like that. You know, because those are like top-end numbers that are typically thrown out there for kind of like maximal rate of loss you want to shoot for. And if you're shooting for those type of rates of loss, you're probably not going to have this just absolutely massive deficit. You know, you're not going to be in a, I don't know, a 3,000-calorie-a-day deficit or something like that, you know, because you'd be dropping too fast.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned rate of loss, and I know our friend Cliff Wilson has talked a lot about this too, but do you want to just explain that concept a little bit? It's very simple, but I think it's one of those things that's just not talked about a lot, especially for more general population.
Yeah. So, I mean, with the rate of loss, it's just the amount of body weight you're losing weekly. And so, you know, and losing at a rate that's going to be meaningful for muscle retention and be more sustainable. So, for example, you know, if you're a 180-pound guy dieting down to 160 pounds and your normal body composition, you probably want to be shooting for, you know, 1% maximum a week. So maybe like a pound, pound and a half a week or so. So you're going to want to give yourself, you know, 16, 20 weeks to drop those 20 pounds, just, you know, so you stay at your target rate of loss. And you know, there'll be plateaus and slower and faster weeks in there and things, but, you know, that would be a reasonable rate to kind of drop those 20 pounds. And it'd be pretty sustainable. And probably if you're dieting that slowly, unless you're getting to extreme levels of body fat, you probably won't see much detrimental effect on your lifts or anything like that either.
Now, is that something you track then? You'd mentioned using a weekly average.
Yeah.
So is that something you just look at on a weekly average and determine, this week my rate of loss, I wanted to be 2 pounds, let's say, for simple math, and I'm only at 1. So do you kind of make an adjustment then based on that?
It depends on the situation. But I mean, so a lot of times I'll have clients who are dieting for shows check in twice weekly, once earlier in the week, once later in the week. And so I take an average, 7-day average each time, you know, so early in the week to early, later, you know, and 7-day averages every time. And just to keep an eye on things. But if it slows a little bit, I don't, you know, if someone's shooting for 1.5 pounds a week and they have a week that's like 0.8, whatever, let's see what happens next week.
Yeah.
You know, assuming they've given themselves enough time to diet for a contest, which is a whole other discussion because...
You mean people don't give themselves enough time?
Yeah. You know, if you have enough time, we absolutely could say, oh, let's see what happens after another week. And that's where, you know, like I said earlier, it comes down to the timeline when, you know, what is a plateau? Like, what do we have to consider a plateau because we have to adjust? You know, if someone who's a guy who's dropping, you know, we're shooting for 1.5 pounds a week, only drop 0.8, if they had enough time, we'd be like, all right, let's see what happens next week. Whereas if they're in a time crunch where we have to see 1.5 pounds a week every week, well, first off, we'd be probably talking about later shows. But if that isn't an option, then we got to make adjustments right away. That's considered a plateau now because we just don't have time.
Gotcha. And what was kind of the first adjustment in more of the extreme case that you would make then? Is it just looking at calories? Do you kind of bump up energy expenditure, or how do you kind of troubleshoot that?
If it's an extreme case, probably some combination of both.
Yeah.
You know, if it's someone who has plenty of time, we might just try lowering calories a little bit and see if that's enough. And oftentimes that's, you know, enough to get things moving again. You know, so maybe a guy who's shooting for 1.5 pounds a week drops like 0.8 one week and maybe 0.9 the next week. So we're just a little slow, but we're still seeing loss. Just small adjustments will do the trick a lot of times.
And with that, this assumes that these are people who are being compliant.
Yes.
And in your brain, what do you kind of use as a marker for compliance? I was talking to Dr. Eric Helms about this a little bit too. So he's got his own kind of, you know, metrics. Because to me, it seems like you either see the people who don't want to track anything at all because that drives them nuts, which, you know, I can understand that. But then you also have the other extreme people where I've had people send me their logs and they're like, oh my God, today was a horrible day. I was 3 grams off my protein. I'm thinking, oh, sure, okay, fine, whatever. You know?
Yeah, no, it depends on it depends on what the person's goal is. So, you know, I always tell clients more extreme goals are going to require more extreme commitment and sacrifice. I mean, it's like anything in life, right? I mean, you know, getting a PhD takes a lot more work than graduating high school.
Yeah.
You know, it does, you know? And so it's the same here. So I always tell people, you know, it depends on your goals. So someone who's dieting for a show, you know, we might be looking at, you got to probably stay plus or minus 5 grams, you know, each day, you know, because we don't have, you're going to an extreme. We got to be tightly controlled. We don't have flexibility because oftentimes you also have a timeline on top of that. You know, so you got to get, not only are you getting to an extreme goal, you got to do that in a set period of time. You're going to have to be pretty tight. Someone who's in the off season or general population, a lot of times we're just looking at falling in like a calorie range for the day and getting adequate protein. Or maybe we're adding a few other things in, like maybe a fiber minimum or a fruit and vegetable minimum, you know, depending on their eating habits. You know, just trying to get more fiber and micronutrient dense foods in them. But, you know, and so for someone who's general population, we may say, fall between, I don't know, 2,200, 2,400 calories a day, eat at least 200 grams of protein or, you know, something, whatever, you know,
sure.
Something like that. You know, and that's good enough because that'll keep them progressing to their goal. And so one thing I also try to point out to people, because I know you mentioned people who hate tracking. One thing I try to point out to people is, you know, you may not like to track, but it's going to be extremely helpful in helping you lose weight. And then my hope is by, you know, in controlling your intake. And then my hope is that while tracking, you're developing habits, you know, and that's ultimately the goal, right, is developing habits so you can sustain things, you know, because long term, some people probably have no issue tracking long term, but others don't want to be tracking every day of the rest of their life. And so it comes down to, you know, during the time you're tracking, you know, use tracking to, you know, you're tracking your intake to make progress, get to your goal. And then when you get there and you're pretty comfortable maintaining there, you start tracking less, and you start relying more on some of those habits, you know, and so you, because hopefully the goal is that you've developed some habits, you know, during the time you've been tracking and working towards your goal, that you can then use those habits to track less. And so, you know, a lot of times I've had a few clients where general population where we kind of got them down to their goal weight, and then they didn't want to track anymore. So we kind of just, you know, first step was, all right, we'll track 5 days this week, take 2 days, don't track at all. As long as their intake's still reasonable on those days and their body weight's not shooting up, all right, let's track every other day. If that goes okay, you know, let's track twice a week, or let's track once a week. And eventually we work towards maybe getting them to where they're just tracking once every couple of weeks just to make sure they're still in the ballpark, and then just keeping an eye on their weight, you know, and getting them away from tracking and more towards habits. But that's typically how I use tracking. You know what I mean? In a general population person is more, we're going to track to get you to your goal. And then from there, if you don't want to track as much, we can start relying more on these habits that you've now hopefully developed. Because I feel like intuitive eating, you know, was a really hot topic, or is a really hot topic, but it heavily relies on having habits that are developed. And most people don't have that from the start, where they can just say, oh, yeah, I'm going to intuitively eat now and lose weight, but I've never tracked or cared about my food ever before, you know?
Yeah, I think it's just a missing level of awareness. And yeah, then also that, very similar to what you said, I explained to clients that it's a skill set to be able to track, and then also not to be able to track, to kind of rely on your habits. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the longer periods of time you can go, the better off you'll be. So I've had periods of time where I honestly don't track anything, you know. Yeah. So like I went to down in South Padre, we were kiteboarding, went on a road trip, we were gone for 4 weeks. I didn't track anything. But on the flip side, I brought a blender with it because we drove, so I stuck the Vitamix in the car, and we went to the store, we bought food, we bought protein, you know. So it wasn't like I was living on Pop-Tarts and beer the entire time either.
You've developed those habits over the years that you're able to use.
Right, and I've done that enough to know that if I'm out being active, I'm usually kiteboarding, we get a, you know, pass at the gym down there, whatever, and, you know, I come back and I didn't measure my weight. I measure my HRV in the morning just more for curiosity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was within a pound of when I left, you know. Yeah. So it's, and again, yeah, but I also know the flip side is if I'm trying to change my body composition,
yes,
the first thing I'm going to do is I'm actually going to start tracking. So now that I'm mm-hmm. back home and working with a coach, so now I'm actually writing, you know, stuff down and actually tracking it again, because I know that's the habit and sort of the skill set if I want to get to the next level of what I need to do. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's exactly it is. I use tracking for change. So I'll have clients where they track a lot less in the off season just because, you know, they either don't want to track as much, or maybe we just go to a looser tracking method where it's maybe just calories and proteins all we care about in the off season, just to give them that mental break. So that way when it comes time to diet for a show, since they're, you know, since that is such an extreme goal, you know, just they're mentally in a place where they're like, all right, I am ready to do whatever I have to do now to get myself to this extreme, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a big thing with the mental breaks of stuff, right?
Yes.
Just getting, you know, time away. And like you said, if you know, if you're working with a competitor, then yeah, you're trying to get to an extreme state that's not normal. You're going to have to do a lot of work. And I give, you know, a lot of credit to people who do physique sports and that type of thing, because it's a 24/7 thing, right? You're, when you get close to a competition, you're probably tracking everything and you're doing everything you can. So I think, you know, having a time to get away and get a little bit of a mental sort of break from all that, I think, can be helpful too.
Yeah, and I mean, that's where having an off season is important too for anyone doing physique sports. You know, you shouldn't be, I mean, there's physiological reasons why you shouldn't stay stage lean all the time and be the person competing, but there are also clear psychological reasons as well. I not only are you probably going to have detrimental health consequences if you stay stage lean long-term and keep competing over and over and over for years on end, but you're probably going to also have psychological consequences just with your overall relationship with food, body image, your ability to stay consistent. And that's where you get people who do 2 hours of cardio every single day. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And last question here, which is kind of more of a case study question. So let's say I have a female client and let's say her goal is to lose 20 pounds, right? But she comes in and she's already exercising pretty good. She's doing some weight training stuff, 3 to 4 days a week, some metabolic type work. Outside stress is a little bit on the higher side, and this is kind of the typical clients I work with too. Mm-hmm. And we start having her track stuff, and her calories are around 1,200 calories. So her calories are already what I would consider on the lower side already. Any thoughts of what you would do with someone like that, since they sort of feel like they've kind of reached a plateau, but they've reached their plateau too early?
Yeah, so I think there's, I guess, a few things. The first thing, like I mentioned earlier, is I would go through and double check that that's absolutely everything they're eating. So for example, if it was a female who was, 175 pounds, trying to get down to 150 pounds, and they're eating 1,200 calories a day and not losing weight, I would probably assume they're eating more. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It doesn't, like the study in the New England Journal of Medicine, it doesn't necessarily add up.
And that doesn't mean they're a bad person either.
No.
Because that's what everyone jumps to. I'm a horrible human because I can't track my food. It's like, no you're not.
If you look normal. There's a study done in dietitians where dietitians were off by, 200 or 300 calories a day. General population, I think, was closer to 500 calories a day that they were off, that they underreported. But the trained dietitians were off by a couple hundred calories a day. Just because you're educated didn't mean you nailed it perfectly.
Yeah.
And so, I think that just being aware that, where all your calories are coming from. And so I think squaring all that away is something that's important. One thing I'd potentially do if they, my question would be then is, okay, then how consistent are you staying with that intake if that is what you're eating? Because sometimes if people are really restrictive, they may be restrictive for 3, 4, 5 days and then just go binge, and then that offsets, loss. That would be another question. And then, how long has it been since you haven't been so restrictive, and maybe take a diet break for a little while. Just raise intake up to something that we're just shooting for maintenance for a while. Let's get you consistent again. Mm-hmm. Something you can consistently hit for a while. And then once you've had a break, let's drop back down. That's something I've done with people before. Usually they try to fight it, but it oftentimes the ones who listen and don't fight it, it ends up working out pretty well for them to have that mental, again, the psychological, the mental break. From the extreme restriction. Eventually, you got to pull back again. And then I guess one last thing I would say in that situation too is I would make sure they check with their doctor that there isn't anything underlying. If they're eating really eating a really low intake and they're not seeing loss, there could be some sort of medical, issue going on that's beyond my scope of knowledge. I've had a couple times where clients, things just didn't sound right or look right when they came to me. And I said, you need to check with your doctor. And, that things like abnormalities in cortisol or abnormalities in thyroid, that doctors have found those things. They've been diagnosed with like endocrine disorders and things, once those are corrected, they can start seeing more progress. But, I have no problem telling people to go see a medical doctor because I am not one.
Oh, yeah, totally. And the flip side, too, is that some people want to assume they have a thyroid condition, but don't want to go to a physician to actually get it checked either. So I totally agree that it's just get a good baseline, just see where you're at. You should be doing that for normal health reasons anyway. So
yeah, and I've had clients where they've you know, kind of along the same lines, where they came to me, thought they were allergic to this, and they couldn't eat. They thought they couldn't eat dairy, they couldn't eat gluten, they couldn't whatever. And then they get tested. You know, I'm like, all right, well, have you been tested? You know, go see for sure. And they go get tested. There's no allergy to anything. And so, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There is no dairy allergy. There is no gluten allergy. They, you know, they just think they can't eat them or they won't lose weight, you know. But, you know, if you really think you have a problem, go to a doctor, you know, like get it checked out. Figure out, like, do you really have, you know, I had a client who found out she had celiac disease halfway through a contest prep.
Oh, wow.
She did extremely well. I mean, she had to change her entire eating, you know, it was just a mild case of celiac, just enough to give her GI issues.
Sure.
And, you know, but nothing terrible, you know, like she.
More of an intolerance.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, they did the tests and they diagnosed her with mild case of celiac. And so, you know, mid prep. And so that's a real medical condition, you know? And so as far as I know, she still eats completely gluten-free and because she has to,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you very much for all your great information today. Greatly appreciate it. Where can people find out more about you?
Yeah. So they can find out about me. My website's fitbodyphysique.com. I'm on Instagram, fitbodyphysique. I'm on Facebook, my regular name, or they can email me at fitbodyphysique@gmail.com.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you very much for all your time today. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.